and welcome to Worlds Apart. When I was coming of age in the early 1990s, right in the aftermath of the Cold War, the biggest dream for many youngsters around the world was to get a scholarship or even a one-way plane ticket to a Western country and never look back. 30 years on, many of those seekers of greener grass or a better life are returning home with a conscious desire to help cultivate their ancestral lands. What's behind that phenomenon and how is it changing the world we live in? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Mehreen Khan, a Pakistani public policy analyst and TV broadcaster. Mehreen, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Oksana.
Now, unlike many post-Cold War immigrants whom I just mentioned, you were actually born and raised in a foreign country. You were born and raised in London. You've got a degree from Cambridge, another one from Harvard. You had a number of seemingly fancy jobs, including one with the UN. And yet you quit it and returned back to your ancestral land. I wonder if this decision seemed a bit eccentric, to put it mildly, even to your own family.
Well, it was actually a family decision. And the thing is that when I was growing up in London in the 80s and the 90s, and I was at school and university, it was a very different place to the UK that we see now. I mean, recently we've seen the First Minister of Scotland has been elected, and he's a young British Pakistani. We've got the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, who's also of Pakistani origin. And of course, we have an Indian origin prime minister in the UK. Now, 30 years ago in the 90s, we would have been hard pressed to predict that. It was a very different society. And I think most of my life was actually my childhood and my student years were dominated by the Thatcher government, a Tory government which was not known for its liberalism. In fact, it stoked a lot of racial tensions. Racism was very overt in England in those days. I'm very happy to say that the newer generations are much more open-minded. They're much more aware of racist or discriminatory narratives, and that Britain is a much better place, I think, for minorities now than it was in the 90s.
Now, I think for anyone who is dreaming about the future in a foreign land, there is a great degree of idealization there. And the bigger it is, the stronger is the disappointment later. I wonder how it was for you, that, you know, cultural shock of meeting the land that you dreamt about.
Yeah, so it's interesting that I grew up in England, which is the destination of choice for many Pakistanis and many Asians in general. And I do, I mean, I'm very grateful that I grew up there because I got an excellent education. I think England is an amazing country in terms of the NHS, the National Health Service, the rule of law, access to justice. And there is a relatively, compared to the rest of Europe and certainly to America, a more free and balanced media. So I absolutely understand that people want to acquire those things. But I would say nowadays, people should look to their own country first. Because if you are educated, if you have a sense of security in your country, if, you know, apart from those people who are, God forbid, being repressed or their lives are at stake or they're so below the poverty line that they cannot even survive, that's a different type of migration. But for middle class people who are educated, I would say if you have a certain level of respect in your country and security and your basic needs are met, you know, the grass is always greener. But when you get there, especially if you go to, let's say, the United States, you would be a second or even a third class citizen for many, many years.
Now, in one of your interviews, you described the cultural shock that you had when you went to one party in Pakistan, and you were the only one who wasn't drinking or smoking there, despite the fact that you weren't actually born in that country. But it was almost like while being born in the UK, you were less westernized than many of the people who have lived in Pakistan their entire life. And I think this is such an interesting point. You also mentioned, you know, the British society is now being increasingly sort of Asianized, Pakistanized, or I don't know, Indianized, if I can put it that way. And I was thinking about whether one can really understand and fully inhabit their culture, their tradition, their spirituality consciously without having some distance from it. Because I think one of the reasons why you can see the Pakistani society the way you see is because you had, you know, sort of the benefit of several different perspectives.
I agree. I think that's absolutely right. Having grown up in England and then coming to Pakistan, which was an identity that was very strong in me. I was very Pakistani, a British Pakistani. And then coming here and realizing that actually Pakistani identity is also in change, in a course of transformation. And so the identity I thought was Pakistan was a few decades old, because that related to an identity my parents had left behind when they moved decades earlier. And so with immigrant communities, what happens is their home country, they leave behind a culture, and the memories are stuck in that time, whereas that culture moves on and transforms and modernizes. So yes, I think it was very interesting for me. And the other thing I noticed was that ultimately the so-called elites in every country are fairly westernized, whether it's Pakistan or any other country, because I was interacting with the sort of educated 1% elite who are very well off, majority of them were inevitably equated westernization with modernization. And I think that is changing now with the internet and with citizen journalism and the access to information. I think people are discovering their own history, Islamic history, Muslim history, Asian history, and delving into their own historical background rather than relying on the mainstream press, which thoroughly filters it, if not blacking it out completely.
You know, one of the things that I was kind of surprised about, that surprised me about you, is when you said again in one of your interviews, is that what you miss the most about Britain is its intellectual stimulation. And I'm certainly biased here, and Russia and the UK have perhaps the worst relationship ever. But when I look at British media and how predictable they are, you know, how homogeneous their narrative is. When I look at certain reports by think tanks and, you know, see the bias and the sort of the relationship with the facts, how casual it is, to put it mildly again. And when I compare it, for example, with the Pakistani discourse, as messy as it is, it strikes me as far more genuine and intellectually honest. So I wanted to ask you, what kind of intellectual stimulation you had in Britain that you cannot get enough in Pakistan?
So I think, you know, that observation was when I was very new to Pakistan. And I think things have improved a great deal in the past few years in Pakistan, with the advent of opening up of private media channels. At the time, we only had one or two, and largely it was dominated by the state channels. So there wasn't as much freedom of debate. Now you're absolutely right. Pakistani media and Pakistani society is much more open to debating different perspectives, especially on international issues. Perhaps we don't reflect as much on our own internal issues with that much objectivity or open-mindedness. But certainly on international issues, yes, Pakistan is a very vibrant place to discuss things. And I think coming from a Russian background or a Chinese background, yes, the diplomats and the journalists would definitely notice that their narratives are carried in a much more balanced fashion.
I do want to discuss broader issues, but before we go there, let me ask you specifically about your success as a high-profile woman, professional woman. And you said before that it was a little bit of a challenge, because with men, if I'm quoting you correctly, there is a presumption that they are competent. And with women, at least the initial presumption is that they have a pretty face. Now, you clearly have both. I wonder if that gives you any advantages, serious advantages, in a still fairly patriarchal society like Pakistan, because you know, that I assume there are not too many women like yourself who have the power of both the beauty and the brains.
So I think Pakistan is a patriarchal society, you're right. And in most fields, there is a male dominant structure. I think women are doing fantastically well in some areas, but really it's got to be scaled up. Yes, women from a certain class who are already educated, perhaps foreign educated, do very well, and they have access to capital through their family wealth or, you know. So those people are obviously doing well. And I although I'm from a middle class family, I had access to educational opportunities in England on merit. And I think that's where Pakistan is has a severe challenge, is that merit has been eroded to such an extent by nepotism, by favoritism, and by politicization of organizations, government organizations and entities, and even in the private sector. So I do think that in that sense, there has to be an overall rethink of the way our society is structured, because it is turning away the middle class, and it's also inhibiting women's talents. But in terms of women striving and making good strides in society, yes, absolutely. We've got female pilots, fighter pilots, a lady who's climbed Mount Everest. You know, yeah, Pakistani women are at the forefront of fashion, music, textiles, all sorts of architecture, all sorts of fields. But it is not widespread throughout society. And we do have some very real issues. For example, I was in a corporate entity here in Karachi, where I live, and I unfortunately had to encounter sexual harassment in the workplace. And in fact, I have launched a case, filed a complaint against the CEO of the company, which is ongoing in the courts. And I've learned a great deal about the real challenges women face in the workplace, even today, and that has to be rectified.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because you also spoke a lot about respecting yourself. I mean, taking yourself seriously, not pompously, not narcissistically, but seriously enough to stand for what you believe and to develop the talents that were given to you. And as much as that seems to be a key to your own personal success, I wonder if that's also something that allows any nation to grow, you know, taking yourself seriously for what you are, with all your, you know, weaknesses, but also your strengths.
Absolutely. I mean, self-belief is a trait that you cannot do without. It's a prerequisite of success. If you don't believe in yourself, nobody else will. And self-belief is about a core value that you have. I mean, it's about having a set of guiding principles in your life and sticking by them and believing that that roadmap for your life is the one you're going to follow with those principles. What you don't abandon is principles. You can change route, you can change tactics, you can even sometimes change the destination, but the principles are there to carry you through. You've interviewed the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, and, you know, he talked about that as well. And he's a great proponent of that incredible determination and self-belief. And to give a vision to a country on a national level, but also to display that in your own lifetime with his achievements, I think he's a great example of what self-belief can do, is transform you from a world-class cricketer to a world-class philanthropist, to an educationalist, and now to a national leader, and indeed a global leader.
Well, Mahreen, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
During the Second World War, in Nazi-occupied Poland, Volhynia was a farming region. Today it's part of Ukraine. Between 1943 and 1945, members of the Ukrainian insurgent army led by Stepan Bandera massacred thousands of Poles in Volhynia in a diabolical ethnic cleansing process. The murders were particularly horrific and brutal. Villages were burned and property looted. The Volhynia massacre is without doubt one of the bloodiest episodes in Polish-Ukrainian history. Why are Ukrainian politicians still reluctant to talk about these events? How do modern-day Ukraine and Poland view this tragedy of the past? And why does the memory of Volhynia still divide people?
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Mehreen Khan, a Pakistani public policy analyst and TV broadcaster. Mehreen, before the break, we started talking about self-perception and national perception. And I know that since returning to Pakistan, you've done a lot of consulting and communication work for various Pakistani entities, including, I believe, a couple of government agencies. And whenever I speak to Pakistani people, I tend to hear that Pakistan has an image problem. Is that indeed an image problem, or is it a problem of self-perception?
I think it's both. I think, and maybe the image problem is because of the self-perception problem. But I think having lived here now for almost two decades, I feel that Pakistanis are still working through the journey of developing an identity, a national identity. There is, you know, we talked earlier about the vibrancy and the dynamics of the media, where all sorts of views and narratives have a chance to debate and come to the fore. But that also has a downside in that everything is up for debate. So nothing is agreed on from the most fundamentals. For instance, right now, our country is going through a massive political, economic, and constitutional crisis. Because even, you know, politicians can say that they would choose not to accept a Supreme Court verdict. Now, in any other country, that would be infallible, you know, inviolable. You couldn't say that. So here, even those basic fundamentals are still being debated and fought out. Pakistan's only 75 years old, and I think the self-identity is going to transform. Younger people are coming in, you know, 65% of the population is under the age of 35. They're not yet in those decision-making seats and positions. And I think as the older generation fades away, younger people will come and that identity will become more solid.
When you say that 75% of the population are fairly young, I mean, for people of those age, it's natural to be concerned about how they look in the eyes of the outside world. Speaking of which, we both participated in a conference recently organized by the Islamabad Security Dialogue, and you gave a very interesting presentation analyzing various countries' efforts to present that national image to the world. And what I found very funny is that Pakistan is continually trying to develop one theme, sort of upcoming potential. You had campaigns like Vibrant Pakistan, Rising Pakistan, Emerging Pakistan. So there's always some resuscitation of the same theme, and yet you don't seem to be able to stick with one slogan in particular. Why do you think that is? I mean, both the commitment to this particular theme of enveloping potential, but also not being able to quite like let it open.
Yeah, because I think one thing that everybody does agree on is that we haven't reached our potential. There's lots of potential, but it hasn't been maximized. It hasn't actually grown and bloomed yet. I think that's what we do all agree on for various reasons. So that's why the theme is always emerging or coming up or about to come up or about to fully realize. The reason they can't agree on a theme is, again, we're so politically fractured. New governments come in, they immediately change everything that the previous government did, you know, as far as possible. And I think until we reach that level of political maturity, it's going to be very difficult. As I said, I do have a great deal of hope, as do most people in Pakistan, that the new generation will allow this change to happen. Because, you know, as they come up and they come into these decision-making positions, they will not have the baggage of history and division that the older generation does. And that's why I'm very hopeful of that.
But on the other hand, I think it's not only Pakistan who is going through this very difficult challenge of essentially differentiation, because we live in an era, in a political era, when most countries have to think consciously, not about just their external image, but about, you know, where they stand politically, economically, whom they support, whom they don't support, what they want to get for themselves, what they're willing to give to others. It's a very, very difficult process for most countries. I interview people from around the world, and I think everybody is pretty much going through the same process of sort of awakening of the selfhood, not only on a personal level, but on a national level and even international level. And I know it's a big question, but you're a person of big visions, so I want to ask you, what do you think it's taking all of us as humanity, this sort of burgeoning of potential all around the world, and everybody seeing themselves somewhat differently from how, you know, others prefer them to be seen?
I think this is one of the great revolutions of social media, is that it has opened up access to information, but it has also allowed people to give their own point of view. So we're no longer reliant on these global news networks, which dominated the 80s and 90s, where you didn't receive any alternative information or viewpoints. I think that's fantastic. And we are seeing a shift from a unipolar, superpower-dominated world to this region, China, Russia, Turkey, Pakistan, Iran, and the Gulf states, taking a key role in this region. Now, India is obviously a strategic ally of the United States, but it has asserted its independence in certain foreign policy issues and decisions, for example, importing oil from Russia. So Pakistan, unfortunately, hasn't been able to do that because, as you know, Imran Khan's government was ousted through a very controversial no confidence vote last year, immediately after he visited Russia and wanted to negotiate with President Putin about importing oil from Russia. And I think that's a classic example of where a superpower has used its influence to interfere with, either directly or indirectly, the politics of a developing country. And you know, it's sad that they do that, because I think those days are over now. The public is much more aware of what's being done to them. You know, it's not 1953 where you can replace an elected democratic government in Iran and replace it with the Shah.
But, you know, old habits die hard. I mean, you know, if a country can, you know, if some people are used to certain ways of doing politics, they will try it until those ways will become totally ineffective. So in a way, it's a natural process.
You know, it was very interesting. A few years ago, I saw the late Tony Benn, who was a real stalwart of British politics, MP on BBC World. And he was opposite John Bolton, who's a US diplomat. And they were talking about something, and Tony Benn made this amazing comment. He said, you know, both our empires, the UK and the US, are in decline, and you've got to accept that. And you know, he got a very rude answer from the American, from John Bolton, but he was an amazingly gracious person, Tony Benn, and I think he was absolutely right. Those empires are in decline, and throughout history, you've seen empires decline and others take their place, and now it is the rise of Asia. It's the 21st century. And these regions we want to trade with our neighbors. We should be able to trade with Russia. You know, we should be able to trade with Iran. And yet we are sanctioned. And it doesn't make any sense for us to be sanctioned like that and not to be able to trade with our neighbors. I mean, neighbors, you can't change your neighbors. You can change foreign policies, but you can't change ever your neighbors.
Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, and we talked a lot about sort of this youth potential of Pakistan, but I want to pay homage to your roots as well. And, you know, whenever I visit Pakistan, I'm always sort of stricken by the legacy of your founding father, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who I think was a man of this amazing cohort of the likes of Ataturk, De Gaulle, Churchill, Gandhi, many others, even though he is much less known around the world. I think he was this very interesting and intricate combination of cosmopolitanism, you know, Western education, fascination with certain aspects of Western culture, but also, you know, genuine appreciation of his own roots. He was never ashamed of Pakistan. You know, he liked a lot this many aspects of traditional culture. And I think this brand of sort of enlightened conservatism is coming back, is making a comeback around the world. My question is, do you feel it in Pakistan? Are you grounded enough in who you are already without certainly closing off the outside influences? Some of them are very beneficial, but also, you know, feeling enough stability in your own identity.
I think that's a fantastic question. And of course, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Qaid Azam, is the founding father of Pakistan. And he is, yes, a much under-researched figure. He was an amazing person who was so intellectually strong. He had conquered, you know, the legal world. He was a barrister from Lincoln's Inn in England, so well respected, highly paid, highly in demand. And yet he had that ability to honor his roots and give the Muslims of British India their identity, which was a separate identity. And, you know, it comes back to what you were talking about, that self-fulfillment of identity. So, yes, I think we have an enormously brilliant example in Muhammad Ali Jinnah. And increasingly, the younger generation is learning more about him. And politicians like Imran Khan have brought that to the fore. You know, Imran Khan in his speeches does quote Allama Iqbal a great deal, the poet philosopher of the East. And he talks about self-determination and realizing your human potential, you know, flying like a Shaheen, the bird in the air, rather than crawling on the earth like ants. And I think that is something that Pakistanis, you know, given the massive popularity that Imran Khan has amongst youngsters, millions of people follow him. And I think he is really starting to invigorate people to say, you can be proud. Yes, a Western education is great. Yes, it's fantastic to have skills, but ultimately you have to be rooted in your identity, because without that, you will float away. You won't be anchored. It's identity and principles which anchor you. Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the quotes about him I've read in one of the books by his contemporary, he said that Jinnah's confidence in himself was incredible, but it didn't make him a narcissist. It turned into this very strong dedication to public service, to his land, and full acceptance of not only who he was, but who his countrymen were, and, you know, what his country represented. So I guess I'm saying that to wrap up and to wish that to all of us and all the viewers around the world from wherever they are.
Absolutely. I think you have to look into your own history. You have to have a sense of pride in your national identity, and a sense of pride in your leaders. If they're giving you a vision and you agree with that vision, then, you know, the world media certainly is not the right thing to judge your country by, because it is so selective and so biased and so agenda driven. I think the debate has to be within your own country, for sure.
Well, within your own country or the countries that permit that scope for a genuine debate. My friend, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.